Yep.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the next session. This is Deepak Saxena. He's going to tell us about how, how to get your code accepted into the kernel, specifically aimed to large files and stuff like that. Okay, I'll hand you over to Deepak now.
Laptop or your supercomputer that you're working on for your research projects,
But it may not work on someone's PlayStation 3. It may not work on someone's little handheld device, which is also analytics. And as soon as you start touching some of these code paths, you have to start thinking about how this is going to affect everyone else. And that's where development analytics is very different than development in some of the closed source operating systems. I've talked to some people who work for closed source OS vendors. And one thing that is very different, even with closed source OS that runs across multiple architectures, is that a lot of times the tree is laid out in such a way, and the source is laid out in such a way that you can go make changes over here in this architecture, and it's not going to affect anyone else because it's just been laid out that way, it's been architected that way from the very beginning. And Linux, we try to be very cross architecture. We try to be very architecture agnostic. And if we add a new feature, a new technology, we want it to work in as many architectures as possible. And you know, one of the things is that it's better to find the issues early on than wait until you're done. If you wait 12 months and then release the code, and then you have to rewrite everything, it's a lot more work on your part. You're going to be much more upset than if you release your code in baby steps, and as you're releasing it, you make the changes. Because in 12 months, then you may have something that's breaking upstream, whereas in the first case, you may have to go spend another 6 months completely rewriting your code. Something that really impacts people who are doing device drivers, if you're working for a device vendor, is there's this idea of writing cross OS abstraction layers. So if you've got a device and it's been working under Windows, and maybe, you know, if you're coming from a Mint environment, it's been working under VxWorks or QNX for a while, and you decide, I want to support this under Linux. And the easy way to do this is to say, well, I'm going to keep my device driver code, and I'm going to write a really cool little shim layer that sits between the Linux kernel and my device driver. Oh, and what that lets me also do is I can have one driver that works across all these operating systems. And I see this all the time, and with Community seeing this all the time. And that sounds wonderful in theory. Abstraction is great. You know, your CS professor would be really excited when you come up with some really cool abstraction layer. But there's some major problems with this in terms of how we develop the kernel in the community. One of the things that having abstraction layer does is that it makes it really hard for the upstream kernel maintainers to maintain your code. One of the things with open source is when your code is in the mainline tree, you're removing some of the burden from yourself to have other people maintain that code. So if there's an API change in the kernel, or if people see that there's a very common misuse of an API, someone's going to go through and fix all those up. If you have an abstraction layer, that's hard to catch because someone can't just look at the code and go, oh, you're misusing that API. They have to look at the code and go, you're calling this abstraction layer, and this abstraction layer is doing this. And as abstraction layers tend to be, they get very complicated. With kind of a simple idea of I'm going to abstract this function call in the kernel with this other function call, becomes some really complex API with lots of different parameters and then lots of magic error detection internally, which should be done within your driver itself. So one of the things that we ask is write Linux native code. Don't take code from another operating system and try to make it work in Linux by some sort of shim. That's just going to make your job harder long term to get it upstream. It's going to make the maintainer's job a lot harder. Now there's a flip side to this. There are times when you want an abstraction layer. And a good example is you've got a piece of hardware, and you're the first one to implement a certain feature, like let's say TCP or UDP checksum offloading, RAID offloading, wireless USB support, whatever it is. And you're like, well, I'm the only one who has this right now, so I'm going to write a driver, and I'm going to put all these capabilities into the driver, and I'm going to have these hooks into the network stack to call my driver. And that's really bad, too, because chances are if you thought of something, someone else is going to think of that too, especially if you're a hardware vendor. Generally, you know, all hardware sort of ends up implementing the same feature set. You may just be the first to market, but sooner or later, someone's going to implement the same feature set. So it's nice in that case to have some sort of abstraction layer or API that provides an interface between the hardware functionality and the kernel, different
internal stack, like the networking stack, or the file system stack, or the block I/O stack. And the key here is that you need to work with the community to add these features. Because again, what we see happening is we see device vendors going and writing these huge stacks of code to support these features without talking to anyone who works on the stuff in the kernel community, and then they release the patch, and we look at it and say, again, interesting idea, yeah, we want this feature, but no other driver's going to use this. Or we're going to have to copy and paste all this code. They're going to have to rewrite a lot of the code to fit their specific device. So before you add any new features, any new APIs, any new hooks or extensions to the kernel, you really want to go out to the community and work with it. There is an issue, which I don't really want to get to this here, which is the whole, I'm working for a company that has a piece of hardware that hasn't been released, and we don't really want to go out to the public and say, well, we're working on adding this feature to the kernel, and all of a sudden everyone knows, oh, your hardware's going to have a feature. There are ways around that. A lot of kernel developers are willing to sign NDAs, even though that may sound contrary to open source development. I've signed NDAs, other developers have signed NDAs, that during this time period when you're doing sort of initial work, this work is being done under NDA. But if you need to make some changes to the networking stack, go talk to the network developers and see if they're willing to work with you to solve your problem. And sometimes you may not be able to get people to sign NDA, but people are very open to working with you if you're open to working with them, and that's the key. And then just talking about some actual code examples, something people like to do a lot is define their own little macros. When there are really well-defined macros that are in the kernel, people like to have custom macros for warnings, custom macros for delays, custom macros for asserting error conditions. We already have all of these in the kernel. The kernel maintainers know what they do, and people are going to miss these when they're trying to do search and replace, they're trying to just clean up the code. So, please use existing code and existing methods. And following up on that, something that I've seen done several times, and I get some specific examples, is not doing your homework in terms of understanding what we do or do not support. We had one hardware vendor who had a system on a chip with I2C controller, and that was a key thing they needed because of the way the board was laid out. They needed to really get to the EEPROM on the hardware through I2C. And they gave us a patch where they've basically written a complete I2C stack just to support that specific chip. And I basically said, well, there's already a driver for I2C. Just go use that. Oh, there's already a driver for the chip you're using. So do your homework. And a lot of times, the problem is that especially working for an embedded hardware vendor, and I pick an embedded because that's the world I come from, and I see this happening a lot in embedded, is your schedules are really tight, and someone's like, well, you just have to get the driver done, and you just go and hack it out and get it done, without really stepping back and saying, okay, what can I actually do? And there is an issue here that documentation isn't the best. I mean, there's a lot of work being done to make documentation a little better, but sometimes it's really hard to just say or find out, I need to support this feature or this weird device, is it supported? The easiest way to do it is to look at the source code. If you're completely new to Linux and this is like your first project you're doing, you're like, yeah, I need to do a port to this board, go ask the right people. Read the documentation. Ask for the right mailing list. If you're doing like an ARM board, go to the ARM kernel mailing list and ask around. Say, okay, I'm doing this. I need to support these devices. What's supported? What's not supported? Use the source. Another example is a hardware vendor had some cryptography offload engines they wanted to support. And at the time they wanted to do this, the Linux Crypto API was still fairly young, but it existed. But they said, well, instead of going and working with the people doing the Crypto API development, we're going to write our own custom device driver with custom outfills and custom interfaces to user space. And that code will never get accepted as stream. Unfortunately, we accepted it into our tree because our customers really wanted it, but as a long-term thing, it's going to be really difficult for MindSplitter or for additional hardware vendors to keep that device server maintained, because it's completely on them now. It's not following any existing methodologies. So maybe I'm confusing you a little, because I said at one point, abstraction bad, net abstraction good, and I take over for the community, develop abstraction. So which one is it? And it really depends on the type of abstraction you're doing. It's almost two types of abstraction. If you think of it like sort of a stack, there's hardware, then there's these kernel interfaces, and then there's the device drivers. It's really nice to have some level of abstraction between the hardware and the kernel itself. Not too much. If you don't want to go too far, end up implementing something like a full PAL like Windows or VxWorks do. But you definitely want some level of abstraction so that if you're writing a device driver, you have some existing API you can hook into to enable and disable different features. Then there's the second level of abstraction, which is you've got these kernel interfaces, they're really well designed, and then you want to put an abstraction on top of that. That type of abstraction layer is really looked down upon, and it's almost an automatic flag that, okay, you just took an existing API and you're trying to hide it with something else. You know, we're really not going to accept this. So here's a really, really bad idea. Implementing user traits in the kernel. We've seen other people doing this. Basically, the example I've got, the national example, I was looking at the code today earlier, is the hardware vendor had a reference platform, and they had a network device on this reference platform, and they wanted NFS boost off of that network, interface. And what they did is, to be able to actually use the network interface, they had to load some programs in the network interface, and so they have the kernel itself mount the flash, go read the file out of flash, load the MAC address out of flash, go load the firmware into the device, and then go initialize the device so they could go on such routes. And we basically said, no, we're not going to put this into our kernel because it's a total pack, and it's really ugly, and you should do this in user space. And their response was, well, how do we NFS root if we can't initialize a network device? You know, how do we do anything with a device if we can't initialize a device? And the device initialization somewhere is somewhere on disk or on flash. And the kernel has something called initNFS, which is a place specifically for this kind of thing. It's there so that when you have devices that need to be initialized and need some special initialization code loaded from user space, you can load the initNFS and you can load the special drivers and special firmware and then go initialize those devices and then finish your boot process. And this is how, for example, installation CDs work for different distributions. You'll boot up the installation CD. It has a very minimal kernel that can initialize, like, the IDE driver or the USB driver, because a lot of CDs are USB now. And then it'll say, okay, what other devices are in the system, and it'll load the proper drivers for those, and then it'll finish initializing the whole system before launching the installer. So it's a well-known method of doing things, and there's a lot of example code out there of how to do this. Distribution maintainers are not maintainers necessarily, but distribution people are good people to talk about this. Because when you're doing embedded systems especially, you're always making a little mini distribution, and that's really the people you want to be talking to and paying attention to is, okay, how is Red Hat, or you know, how is Debian handling this weird driver that needs this weird firmware loaded, or this other sort of desired bootup scenario. You know, that's one of the beauties of open source, is there's a lot of information out there that you can learn from. So something else I want to point out in terms of how not to interact with open source community is basically say, I'm smarter than you, I have 20 years of experience, I've been doing this for a really long time, you should listen to me. I'm not going to read the whole code because you can read this, but we see this happen every so often, where there are people who have really great experience doing software development, doing OS development, doing embedded systems work, whatever it is, who have been working in a closed-source environment who comes to Linux. And if you're working sort of, let's say, a traditional program environment, seniority is really big. And even in Linux, seniority is big, because certain people have, their say is usually more valuable than other people's say, because they've been working on this code for a long time. But in Linux, what really matters in the end is the code and the technical validity of the code and the concept and your technical input. So you may have 20 years of experience working on file systems or working on network stack development, and you may publish some code for Linux, which you've written that same sort of code before for some other operating system, and people may just listen and go, well, it's a great idea, but this is wrong, and this is opening up all these holes. And there's two ways to react to that. One way is, well, no, I mean, I've done this before. It clearly works. I mean, you guys need to adopt your operating system to work with this technology that's been around for 20 years. Or the other way to do it is to say, well, okay, let me try to understand why this doesn't work in this environment, and let me try to work with the people who are giving me that feedback and understand what I need to change in my code and possibly what needs to change in Linux. Because, you know, we don't want a kernel that's just stagnant. We want a kernel that evolves, and we want it to evolve to support new technologies, but it has to be done in the right way. And this sort of goes back to this idea I mentioned before, that when you add something to Linux, when you add new features to Linux, new technology, you're touching a lot of different code paths. Your code recipe may not touch one code path, but let's say you're adding a new file system. Linux has a standard set of semantics that it's expecting out of file system. End users have a set of semantics they're expecting out of file systems. So if you say, I want to throw in this new file system that has these features that may not fit into the semantics, something needs to change somewhere, either in the kernel file system layer, or your file system, or some user land tools. So there's just a much bigger problem than just, I've got this code, and it's been working in my lab for a long time, and so you should accept it. Something else that we see happening is what I call indirect participation. And this is really for hardware vendors more than anyone. Where you hire a team of people to work on your Linux drivers or some subsystem, and then you only let one person of that team actually interact with the community. And everything is filtered through that person, and that person is the one interacting with the open source community and with the kernel developers. Now, there's some good points and bad points. You want to have someone in your team or any other development model who's sort of the senior person that can, you know, look at something before it does go upstream, catch really simple mistakes, so you're not, you know, spending extra time and energy pushing things upstream and having to go rewrite them, instead of wasting everyone's time in a way. But what you're missing then is sort of this direct interaction that if I write some code and I give it to you, and you push it upstream, and it's a pretty complicated piece of code, and all these questions come back to you saying, well, why are you doing this? What about this case? What about that? You can't directly answer those. You have to go directly, you want to go directly to that developer, and the developer has to answer those. And the developer is really the only person who can answer those questions the best. So what you want to do if you're working in the kernel development environment, or really any other open source development environment, is the developer has direct facing to the community. And that's something, it's sort of a mindset that when you work in open source, your developer is part of your team, but your developer is also part of this open source community team. Not all the time, but during the developer work of this new driver and this technology, they need to go and face that community and be willing to spend the time communicating with the community and answering questions as they come up. And something that also comes out of this is this case where someone will say, I think my customer is doing such and such, and my customer ran into this issue, and I don't really know how they're reproducing it, But here's the issue, and here's the patch. And I've seen this a couple of times, and I've seen this both in the community, I've seen this from our hardware vendors who have really big customers who find issues. If you don't tell us how to reproduce an issue, if you don't tell us exactly how you found the issue, well, we're not going to be able to help you very much. Because just saying you have a patch to fix this, especially in really complicated cases, it's nice to know how exactly did you find the bug? What were you doing? Is it actually a bug that you found? Or is it that, well, the customer is making assumptions about how the system should work. And this patch really is needed because there's really nothing broken in our code. It's their code that's broken. But we need more direct interaction and more input to be able to do that. Something else. This isn't really a code submission thing, but this is more of when to get involved with the community about an idea. So some other operating system out there provides some feature, and some other operating system with a larger market share. So clearly, Linux should also do this. And a good example came out of this one last week is, let's go implement a game API in the kernel. Because Windows has a really awesome game API, and they've got great market share in both the console market with like the Xbox, and they've got, you know, that's where all the games are being developed. If you want to get more market share with GameClear, we need to have a gaming API in the kernel. That doesn't make any sense from a lot of technical reasons. But luckily, this person said, I'm going to go say this idea, and they might get some ridicule, but that at least people can honestly tell them, well, these are the problems with this. Instead of, I have, again, the same thing. If I have this idea of something I want to do, and it should, and I'm going to go do it, and then I'm going to go say, I've done it already. Because if suddenly I come to us, let's say the person decides, I'm going to go write a game API in the kernel, and they went and spent 12 months and then released code to us, and we just said, no, there's no way this is ever going into our kernel, they might be a little upset. So it all comes back to release early, release often, and more importantly, communicate early, communicate often. This is one of the more technical ones. This is especially done by a lot of embedded people when they're writing device drivers or when they're porting the kernel to a new chipset or a new CPU or a new system on the chip. They'll write their code so that it really only works on their reference platform. And a lot of times that's all they care about because they have a reference platform and they want to sell this to lots of people so that lots of people can develop applications. So they write the code. A lot of times the code is written as validation code. A lot of embedded hardware chipset vendors now are using Linux to do early validation of their hardware. So the code is written so it's tied to a very specific platform. And the idea is, well, if someone's going to do a new board, they'll just go rewrite part of the code. And that really defeats how a lot of Linux is written. Because this is going back to the abstraction thing. This is a place where abstraction is good. You want to write your code in such a way that someone can pick up the rest of the platform and say, I'm going to change this whole thing around. I'm going to remove this device because I'm going to add this device. And easily take your code you've written as a starting point, as an example of how to write their forward port, and not have to do a lot of new code development. Because if something is just very simple between two pieces of hardware, unless you're just an IRQ change or some memory mapping has changed, someone should have to copy and paste a whole chunk of code and clean it up to make it work on their platform. And I see this all the time coming out of the embedded chipset manufacturers. Another more technical low-level example is, it sort of goes back to this idea I had earlier of why to turn loose your code to people in the community to get review is, if you're a device driver vendor especially, chances are you're only working on x86. And there are things that will work on x86 that won't work on other hardware. And just to go into a little nitty-gritty detail right now, one of these is, the Linux kernel provides a function called IRVMap that lets you take a piece of physical memory and remap it to virtual address space. And then you can use that to go access hardware. What does a lot of traditional embedded art classes is you have some address, the piece of hardware, and you just go reason, right, you just poke at it directly. And that will work on most x86 platforms, really, except some of the higher end stuff that have IMMUs. But possibly the desktop system you're running your driver on, it might work. It probably won't work a lot of other platforms, because there are other platforms where the concept of like I/O space and memory map I/O completely falls apart, either because they have a fully deployed accessing I/O, or they have completely different concepts of what is I/O. Is I/O actually a separate memory space, or is it not a separate memory space? So like an example of how this would be done is you email this address, and then the kernel has an API called read long to go read a piece of memory. And on x86, all it does is what the original code is. It just goes out and reads a piece of memory. One of the CPUs that I maintain the port to, we actually have to check that address. If the address is in some weird range, we actually have to go issue a bunch of different commands to this command processor to go access this memory. And you don't know that as a device driver, and you shouldn't have to know that. You shouldn't have to know how does I/O, how does this work in this specific processor. So using existing APIs is really important. And again, releasing the code is really important, because if you wrote code like that up there and you release that to the community, people are going to catch that and say, oh, that's not going to work for this processor. So, you know, please don't do that. You'll use this. Something else that comes up is what I'm calling the hypothetical system. And this is actually an example from my employer. You still hear me? Does the microphone work out? Okay. Was that good? So we work with really large telecom system vendors who build these systems that have hundreds of processors sometimes and thousands of disks. You know, these are things that are running at the back end of your telecom company, routing telephone calls all over the place. And this was about the time that the Linux kernel started supporting things like hotspot devices, and we moved away from traditional methods of the site discovery towards UDEV. It was before kind of like HAL and debug for them. And a couple of engineers said, you know, this isn't really going to work for us. And I'm paraphrasing everything here. And basically they said, our customers are going to be running thousands of disks, and boot up is going to take way too long because of the way UDEV is written. It's calling fork for every disk that's discovered. So for every time the disk has all these system calls happening, it's just going to take a really long time to boot up. This is unacceptable for our customers. It's part of this error-based specification, which requires such and such timing. So therefore, we want to see this change. And we've rewritten hotspot handling, and we've rewritten and replaced the UDEV code. The response from the committee was basically, well, that's nice, can you show us some numbers that this is actually happening? Well, no, because we don't really have access to that kind of equipment. And this actually happened for a while. It's happened a couple of times, where our engineers rewrote the code, they tried to respond to the feedback, but and we didn't really have any hard data. I mean, we could look at the code and say, it makes sense this was going to happen, but I mean, some of you attended Dave Jones' talk just now, a lot of people just need to get that hard data to see what exactly is the system doing. And in the end, I believe right after we rewrote parts of UDEV to not use fork and to do things in a different way and to handle some of these issues, and it took a couple of iterations, and it took this problem showing up on like everyday systems with like lots of USB devices that need to be discovered at boot up before it got fixed. So the idea was right. The problem didn't exist, but the issue was that as kernel developers, there are people who are curious and who like theory. But one of the things that keeps coming up, and Linux will say this a lot also, is we want real data. We want to see real applications that use the changes that you're making to the kernel. And reality trumps assumptions and specifications. You may say, well, I need to write this code because this specification over here says that this must work in this way. But if in reality, every piece of hardware works in this other way, good examples of things not to do. First of all, using completely incorrect style, so that's basically copying a lot of things on Windows, in Hungarian notation. If 0 not equals minor, don't do that. Change, but yeah, the variable always goes first. And then just the style, there's a couple of calls to specific macros here, like the NILP print debug. If I look at the actual code for that macro, all it is a print hit. This T driver context create, all it is a knowledge call. Right? So why hide all these things with these special hidden APIs? And then don't use Windows programming notation within the Windows kernel. Those are just sort of an example of where everything is sort of done incorrectly. How am I doing on time? So, what I've done is I've summary. Release early means often. This is sort of how to do things right. And just a few times we'll try to hear something like this, but if it boots, ship it and release it to the community. Because what you're initially doing when you release the community is almost a proof of concept. Because one of the things with open source development, and with any software development really, is that it's never stuck. It's always evolving, it's always changing. And so if you release it early, you're going to get input into that evolution process and the right process early on. Understand that there's more than just your hardware, more than your device, more than just the stack you're working on. And your code may have ramifications you can't see. Again, that's why you want to release. Follow existing APIs and coding standards. And really, I think the one of the most important things is treating the community as an extension of your team. You're developing something that you want to see go into the kernel because you want to not have that burden. You want your device to be supported out of the box by Fedora, by SUSE, by whoever. So listen to feedback. Work with people who need to add the changes you need to the kernel. Provide the proper data, you know, in terms of performance or whatever that is you're trying to deal with. Ask the questions to the right people. A little bit I put up there, kernelreview.org. If you're new to the kernel, oh, really? No, I don't know.
It just died
after that change. I don't know. I'm actually not involved with that community, so I can't answer that. There's a kernel EV's IRC also. I forget which IRC network it's on. Is it FCC? Okay. And that's a place where a lot of people who have a lot of kernel experience hang out in, and they're willing to help people who are new, either directly answer a question or just sort of point you in the right direction. Okay, I need to do this. I'm not sure where to look. Or go look at the source code. Go look at the documentation. Be courteous. That's just a nice rule for any sort of environment. But you would be courteous to people within your software team. If you want to interact with the community and work with the community and have them give you things and you want to give them things in exchange, be courteous to them. And then let your engineers interact with the community. You know, both in terms of directly facing the community, but also send them to places like LCA and OLA. Make them part of the community so that when people see a patch coming from your engineer for a subsystem, they know this person. They know who this person is, and they're like, okay, I know this person. I've had a beer with this person. There's a trust there that's built when people actually meet with each other face to face that doesn't happen over the email interaction. So that's all I really have, and I want to open up to questions or comments or horror stories.
Okay, so as much as you don't like to admit it, every once in a while you do everything right, and you're working with the community in a respectful manner, and you've got this maintainer who's, I don't know, bipolar, and no matter what you do, he won't merge your patches. So what's the exception path? How do we handle this?
So, as long as it's not with us, you know, you've got no one else to really go to. And I've had to do this before. I mean, like, I work in the ARM community, and our maintainer is really smart and sometimes very difficult to work with. And sometimes I just have to basically say, well, I'm not able to get it up to this chain, so I'm going to just have to go up another level. I'm going to go directly to LTML. priorities with why. But sometimes that will back priority too. And that's, I think, one of the things that, as a community, we can figure out how to do, because we're trying to be fully distributed, but there is a hierarchy in place, and there's a hierarchy of trust and of control. Okay, I maintain the subsystem, so people are best positioned to say, well, we trust that person to go maintain a subsystem. And there have been cases of subsystems where it's been like a coup d'etat, basically, where the people who are developing that subsystem say, you know, we're doing a lot of work, and you're not being very helpful to us to get the code upstream, so we're just not pushing code upstream directly. And at some point, either that maintainer just say, well, okay, I need to rethink how I'm doing things, or say, well, I'm going to have to step back, because how I want to do things and how reality is happening, I don't think it's an easy answer to that. It's really a question of that.
If you're a small company with a particular peripheral that you need to implement your to solve your business problem, and it's not something that's designed for shipping to the rest of the world, it's not a PC peripheral, something like that, may only be for use of your company. What happens with patches that you might want to use?
That's actually okay. We have the PowerPC tree, I believe, there are ports to boards that maybe only two exist in the world. And the whole idea is that even though we're also going to actually get that piece of hardware, it's that whole idea again that, oh, the API is changing, so someone's going to go update your code, and you don't have to think about it, because someone's gone through and updated everything and using this API. Or, oh, this API usage is really long and there's a bug, so no one will fix that bug for you. So I think that's an advantage.
So as long as the driver is more or less written in a way that would generally be accepted, it would be carried even though it's low volume?
I believe so.
I think that's true, and all the other aspects is that what you'd like, that it might not be a board.
So it might not be a board just now that's useful to everyone else. A lot of the reason we have some of those one-off, two-off boards in the town, they do, for example, is that we could expect them to be used in the longer term than they just like it. So it gives people a reference, a starting point they can work on. So yeah, I think it certainly works good that effort, and even for very low common use systems.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much.